outline. The similarities are actually quite striking. In both cases, there were significant kingdoms. They tended to be larger in Africa than in Europe, but loosely organized. African kings might claim divine kingship, but in fact their power rested on careful negotiation and conciliation of the warrior class. And this was, while Africa did not develop literal feudalism, this had some overtones of the jockeying necessary in the European feudal monarchies. Both Africa and Europe were developing new commercial centers. Merchant classes were on the rise. Both saw increased activity linking commercial patterns to those of the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And in both instances, merchant activities were important not only in their own right, but in stimulating other economic developments, for example, mining in the case of Africa, and in stimulating political activity as well, as we have seen. These then were cases in which you had two emerging civilization areas still fairly loosely structured politically, though with definite states and political apparatus, exploring commercial opportunities, exploring new cultural expressions, etc. The same comparison, however, and this is the point on which we'll end, the same comparison also notes, however, that if you take the two societies 200 years later, in 1450, the comparative situation changes markedly. By 1450, and we'll explore this a little more fully next time, by 1450, European societies, particularly Spain and Portugal, were actively engaged in exploratory trips down the African coast. They were reaching out toward new world roles. They were developing more rapid changes in political and cultural systems. African societies in no sense were lagging compared to their own past. Kingdoms ebbed and flowed. The kingdom of Ghana had yielded to the rise of Mali. By the end of the post-classical period, Mali is fading somewhat and will be replaced by another network of kingdoms, including Songhai. But these were ebbs and flows that really didn't distort the basic framework of African history. But there is not the same kind of outreach and commitment to major change. And the final question is, why? And the answer involves several factors that shed light back on post-classical African history as well. Factor number one, sheer geography. Western Europe possesses an abundant river system that creates navigable possibilities connecting inland areas to the oceans. Africa, for the most part, sub-Saharan Africa, for the most part, does not. African rivers are not easily navigable from ocean inland, and they were therefore less obvious as a stimulus to seagoing activities. Except for the Swahili coast, Africans did not develop a significant commitment to naval activities during the post-classical period or obviously before. So, geography. Second, relationship to Islam. For Western Europe, trading with Islam was always tense. It was always, to some degree, trading with the enemy. There was always a certain level of resentment and anxiety. For Africans, trading with Islam was non-problematic. It was fine. Africans were either Muslims or familiar with Muslims. They didn't have a problem here to be solved. Third, balance of payments. Western Europe, as we've noted previously, had significant difficulty in coming up with goods that they could use in exchange for products they wanted from world trade. Africa had much less of an issue here. They traded slaves, they traded gold, they traded other agricultural products. I don't mean there was never an economic issue, but there, again, was not the same kind of problem to be solved as existed in Western Europe. And finally, as we've also noted before, Africa, unlike Europe, had had no particular interaction with the Mongol interlude and therefore no particular opportunity to connect to new sources of technological change. Again, a contrast with Europe. So 1450 finds the fates of these two societies beginning to diverge, in a way reflecting how successful post-classical African developments had been. Africa did not face the same need for difficult transitions, for ambitious outreach that Western Europe did. Perhaps this was unfortunate, but it was at the very least an ironic cap to a very important and very impressive period in the history of sub-Saharan African societies.
Lecture 18, The World in 1450.
Almost all world historians agree that 1450 or 1500 constitutes a significant break in world history. Today we're going to talk about developments in 1450. We'll make a brief bow at the end to 1500. I don't think the tensions here are terribly significant. We're going to be talking about 1450 in terms of significant changes taking shape in a number of different regions of the world, not just one. The context, just by way of reminder, the context is twofold. First of all, by 1450, the great era of Arab politics and merchant activity has passed. Arabs are still a vigorous people. There are a number of Arab states. Arab religious and cultural activity remain considerable. But the central role that the caliphate and the Arab version of Islam had played is obviously over. Also over is the Mongol era, definitively, by 1450. There are still pockets of Mongol rule. There are pockets of Mongol population, for example, in the Crimea, where a Tatar minority exists to this day, expelled by Stalin and newly returned since the fall of communism. But the Mongol era is over. So an overarching question in the world in 1450 was, given the demise of these two great systems, which had so dominated the post-classical period and its transitional ending, and given the continued importance of interregional economic and cultural contacts, what kind of system would come to be in the place of these previous frameworks? Specific developments focused initially on China. The big news during the first half of the 15th century was actually primarily Chinese news. The Mongols had been expelled from China at the end of the 14th century. A new dynasty, the Ming, was in power in China and, like many new dynasties, was full of vim and vigor, benefiting from an expanding economy, interested in new political statements, interested in territorial expansion to a degree, although remember, the Chinese have never historically been devoted to expansion as a primary guiding principle. Under the Ming, beginning in 1405, a series of Chinese expeditions were mounted, which took Chinese troops and goods and political and cultural representatives from the Pacific coast of China through Southeast Asia to South Asia to West Asia and to the Indian Ocean coast of Africa. These great expeditions, organized in huge ships, so large that they actually could carry not only domesticated animals, but actually gardens to feed the expeditions as they moved along. These huge expeditions were probably mounted primarily to extend the old Chinese custom of seeking tribute from neighboring contacts, and certainly the expeditions were actively utilized in this vein with political representatives from several of the visited territories coming back to China, bringing tribute with them, sometimes held until they provided appropriate tribute in turn, a specific goal of establishing more politics-free commercial networks was probably not involved. But be that as it may, for virtually 30 years, the Chinese expeditions mounted every several years, provided the most striking interregional contacts that were operating during the 15th century as a whole. These expeditions, commanded interestingly by a Muslim Chinese, a eunuch named Zheng He, these expeditions were extremely successful in bringing Chinese connections to Indonesia and other parts of Southeast Asia, in obviously establishing a new kind of Chinese presence in India, in establishing new Chinese links directly with the Middle East, particularly the Persian Gulf region, and with the states of East Africa. Chinese coins and other artifacts have been found from these expeditions in considerable abundance. Speculation has one wondering, did at some point as the Chinese expeditions moved along the East African coast, at some point did the expeditions reach the southern tip of Africa and peek into the Atlantic, and did the leaders wonder, should we go there? They didn't. We don't know that for sure. One historian recently has written a book arguing that one of the Chinese expeditions actually crossed the Pacific. It's an amazing piece of historical imagination based on essentially no evidence whatsoever, and there's no reason to think it's accurate. But even dismissing this, this was an important series of expeditions, a delightful episode in world history, an important assertion of Chinese economic strength. Remember, these expeditions built on the established position of Chinese manufacturing that had begun to be embellished in the Song Dynasty, extended under the Mongol Yuan Dynasty, and now obviously confirmed by this explosion of a statement of Chinese dynamism and commercial and military strength. But the expeditions ended in 1433 by an imperial decision. The motives for this decision seem to have been several. There may have been a certain traditionalist bureaucratic suspicion of these costly expeditions on grounds that they gave too much attention to naval activities, too much attention to commercial groups. We don't know that, and it's important not to overdo the conservatism that this decision implies. There certainly were specific factors. A new Ming emperor had come to the throne, and like many political newcomers, he wanted to establish that his policies were going to be different from those of his predecessor. So probably a certain amount of sheer whim entered in. It's also possible that while the tribute received from the expeditions had been considerable, the crude economic calculation, at least in terms of short-run cost benefits, argued for termination. Without question, and this is, I think these two are the more important causal factors, without question, the new dynasty, the new representative of the dynasty, felt that there were two more important purposes for investment monies. One was to establish a new Ming capital in Beijing, which began as the expeditions ended and turned out to be both magnificent and costly. This was the point at which the famous Forbidden City began to be constructed, a series of new tombs for the Ming emperors. These were costly investments, which arguably paid off in terms of the prestige of this new capital, but certainly made it difficult to consider doing the two major enterprises at the same time. The other major investment was, of course, the redoing of the Great Wall. The concern about making sure the Mongols now out, stayed out, seemed to warrant this huge defensive investment. Obviously, the Great Wall is one of the famous architectural symbols of China, deservedly so. It was also extremely expensive. Again, hard to do too many things at once. The ending of the Chinese expeditions did not end China's economic role in world trade. It did not isolate China from the rest of the world. These points we will need to return to. But obviously, the end of the expeditions did signal a terminus to the brief flurry of Chinese initiative going this far toward the rest of the world. Chinese activities, including merchant colonies in Southeast Asia, remained. They had been strengthened by the expeditions. There's a lingering impact here. But the extent of Chinese outreach that these expeditions had represented would frankly not be matched by China until the late 20th century. The change also, the decision to end the expeditions, also re-raised the question that I started with. If the Chinese weren't going to organize the next interregional trade system, who would? And the answer was obviously going to be clear fairly soon. We'll come back to it. A second center of developments around 1450, involved the Middle East and Southeast Europe. The decline of Arab rule had left openings for the in-migration of new peoples from Central Asia, particularly Turkish people. Several waves had come in already. Turkish populations had been prominent in parts of the Middle East during the Crusades. Turks had been used in the administration of the later Abbasid caliphates. So Turks were not new to the region, but around 1450, a new group of Turks, the Osmanli or Ottoman Turks, began to come in from Central Asia. Remember, they were already Muslims, actually quite fervent Muslims, heavily influenced by Sufism. They began to migrate into the area, and they began to be organized militarily, taking territories not only from Arab states, Arab rulers, but also increasingly focusing on an attack on the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire, a major factor during the post-classical period in politics, trade, and obviously cultural outreach, the Byzantine Empire had been declining considerably for some decades before 1450. Its territories shrunk, increasingly finding it difficult to maintain the great city of Constantinople. The Byzantines were already in trouble, and obviously this declining economic and political strength made them a ripe target for this new series of interlopers. The Turks would lay siege to Constantinople, and in 1453, the city fell, to be renamed by the Turks Istanbul, although the rest of the world acknowledged this name only more recently. The fall of Constantinople in 1453, is one of the great single events in world history, both for its real impact and its symbolic meaning. For the Middle East itself, it obviously represented a clear step, not a final step, but a clear step in the establishment of a new Turkish, or more properly, Ottoman Empire that would provide a new source of political and military power to a region that had been fragmented now for almost two centuries. The fall of Constantinople also represented a new opportunity for the Turks and for Islam to move into the Balkans, to move into southeastern Europe. And already, even before the fall of Constantinople, the Turks had seized territories in parts of present-day Greece. The change then to southeastern Europe was, in many ways, just as great as the impending change for parts of the Middle East itself. Russia was obviously hugely impacted. The Byzantine Empire had been the model for Russian development. The collapse of Constantinople, on the one hand, represented a rather terrifying challenge to Russian sense of identity. But it was also equally a liberating possibility, because Russia could now see itself as inheriting a mission from the old Byzantine Empire, and that would play some role in the new surge of Russia that we'll come back to in just a moment. The fall of Constantinople, finally, was a symbolic and real challenge to other parts of Europe, including Western Europe. West Europeans, particularly Italians, had treated Constantinople very scornfully in the last days of the Byzantine Empire. As we've noted previously, one crusade actually invaded Constantinople directly in hopes of plunder and in hopes of reducing commercial competition. And West Europeans did not pay any attention to appeals from late Byzantine emperors for assistance against the assailing Turks. They ignored it. But when the city fell, the sense of threat, the sense that a bastion of Christianity had been removed in favor of a new and fairly potent Islamic presence, was something that Europeans had to grapple with quite directly, and it would take some time to assimilate. The Middle East then and southeastern Europe were a second center of change, along with the oscillations in Chinese economic activity and interregional policy. Associated with the fall of Byzantium and the rise of the Turks was the extent to which the early 15th century represented the point at which Russian political rulers began fully to cast off Mongol rule. Process began to heat up around 1420. And by 1450, as we've already noted, a real Russian state was forming around Moscow, and it was steadily expansionist. The fall of Byzantium was actually an additional spur to this Russian expansion. The Russian ruler carefully married one of the daughters of the last Byzantine emperor to maintain a clear link between a new Russian mission and the now failed Byzantine mission. And we will have to come back to this important assertion of Russian power as it began to take shape around 1450 as well. Not every place was changing in 1450, or not every place was changing massively. We've noted already that there was considerable basic continuity in Africa. African historians insist, of course, quite properly, that Africa must not be viewed as changeless. There were significant political shifts, alterations of trading patterns. The rise of the new kingdom of Songhai was an important development in the Sudanic region. But African stability compared to developments elsewhere, I think, can be legitimately emphasized as well. Japan, of course, was digesting a certain degree of change. Again, we've noted earlier that the failure of the Mongol efforts to invade Japan, in contrast to their success in China, gave Japan a bit of food for thought and a new opportunity to rethink Japanese relationships even with the Chinese. 1450 is not a striking point in Japanese development, but again, we need to remember that there was a bit of an adjustment going on in this case. Developments in India are not marked by any dramatic shifts around 1450. The more dramatic changes will come 50 or 70 years later with a new series of Islamic invasions into India. So that's hovering in the wings, but not yet there. There were, however, by sheer coincidence, because remember, there's no connection yet between American patterns and those elsewhere, there were significant developments in the Americas. Both the Aztecs and the Incas, by 1450, were beginning to encounter new challenges to their rule. Subject peoples were becoming more restive. The Inca Empire was probably overextended. Remember, its vast territory along a mountain stretch was very impressive, but also hard to sustain. So quite spontaneously, quite independently of anything else, the great political structures of the late post-classical period in the Americas were beginning to unravel to some extent, and this would obviously facilitate European entry after 1492. No connection yet, but they need to be noted as simultaneous developments. The final series of major developments occurred in new forms of European outreach. Beginning as early as the 13th century, individual European merchants and rulers had shown some interest in breaking the confines of European geography and its focus on the Mediterranean as an artery of trade which inevitably led to interaction with and dependence on Islamic merchants and Islamic centers of power. In the 13th century, a genuine expedition set out into the Atlantic. Obviously, the Atlantic was potentially the great escape hatch. We have no idea what happened to it. They never came back, but the fact that they went is actually an interesting revelation. Farther to the north, of course, Scandinavians had crossed the Atlantic, and Scandinavians had successfully reached North America, found nothing that they particularly valued there, and retreated to more interesting and durable settlements in Greenland and particularly Iceland. So there's a bridge in the north, but it's not one that connects particularly to developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. By the early 15th century, patterns of exploration in the Atlantic, down the African coast, were beginning to extend quite routinely. Sponsored particularly by the King of Portugal, newly freed from Muslim control, but with some interest also by rulers in Spain, where also Islamic control was being pushed back. The last Islamic enclave in Granada would fall in Spain in 1492, an interesting coincidence of dates. The explorations steadily pushed down the African coast. The purpose was, let's see what we can find. Maybe they're great sources of gold, an understanding that Africa had considerable gold supplies, and myths about even greater riches were rampant in Europe at this point. So there was a clear mercenary tinge. The larger framework, remember, the larger framework was a European recognition that it did face some severe difficulties in the interregional relationships that had developed during the post-classical period. European taste for Asian goods, upper-class taste primarily, was well established. There's a consumer stake here. There's money to be made. But at the same time, the European capacity to pay for these goods was not terribly well established. By seeking new sources of gold, by seeking other opportunities, the Europeans were obviously trying to remedy what was just front and center, a clear problem in their interregional outreach. They also began to wonder if by pressing down Africa, they could find a direct connection with Asia itself and thus save money by avoiding the Islamic middlemen and save cultural challenge by bypassing Islam in favor of connections with Asia directly. This interest in, again, a combination of a cultural and economic solution to the problems of dependence on Islamic merchants. This effort to find a solution was galvanized further by the fall of Constantinople, by the sense of a new level, a new potential for Muslim organization in the Eastern Mediterranean. The spur here was considerable. The conventional textbooks on West European history obviously emphasize the background to these new expeditions in a somewhat different fashion. And there's no reason that we have to choose fully between them. It was certainly true that by 1450, European political capacity was beginning to improve. There was still a great deal of internal warfare. Indeed, the great Hundred Years' War between England and France was still raging. But European feudal monarchies in England, France, and now increasingly Spain and Portugal, European monarchies or feudal monarchies had managed to achieve a bit more central control over their territories. They did have somewhat greater capacity to guide trade policy, to do things like mount significant exploratory expeditions. European Christianity, not a new force, may have been given a new lease on life in terms of missionary spirit by the success of driving the Muslims out of the Iberian Peninsula. Sometimes this kind of success will help promote a further sense of great zeal, and Spanish and to a lesser degree Portuguese Catholic leaders were prominent in playing roles in the explorations that began to take shape in the 15th century, a motive of religious conversion associated with a desire to push Muslims farther back from Europe may have been a spur here. And certainly we need to acknowledge that 1450 was a point at which new attitudes in the Renaissance were developing, first in Italy and by 1450 beginning to spread more widely. And the Renaissance did suggest a new level of attention to activities on this earth rather than simply religious motivations. They did suggest some new confidence in the possibilities of individual achievement. No accident that some of the great explorers would turn out to be Italian, the center of the Renaissance. But I think the world history picture has to continue to be more complicated. The European expeditions down Africa may have had some religious motivation, although the commercial economic motivation was much stronger at the outset. There may have been some Renaissance spirit involved, but the sense of key problems to be solved, the sense of a need to deal with the problem of the Islamic intermediary, the sense of the need to compensate for the new Islamic control in the Eastern Mediterranean, these spurs were very real as well. As the